Okay.
This interview is being conducted on Monday, February 16th, 2015, with Mr. Coy Alexander at the Indian Prairie Library in Darien, Illinois. My name is Deb Barrett. Mr. Alexander was born on March 8, 1945, in Childersburg, Alabama. He is retired from the technology service industry and works part-time in auto auctions. He learned of the Veterans History Project through Joe Schulach, his father-in-law, who also interviewed for this project. Mr. Alexander has kindly consented to be interviewed for this project. Here is his story. So, Coy, just before you entered the service, where were you living? What was your life like at the time?
Well, I was living in Alabama in Talladega County, where Childersburg is, and most of it was I was farming, helping my father on a farm and helping a neighbor on his farm.
What kind of farm was it?
Mostly cotton, you know, corn, other stuff, soybean. So it was mostly just, you know, regular farm stuff. We helped with the cattle. My neighbor had he raised cattle, so I helped him with his feeding and taking care of.
Okay. Were you in school at all, or was this after?
After school. I mean, okay. I finished school, and I started to work at Bonnet Mills. It was a textile place, but unfortunately, after I started, they closed the plant. So,
okay.
In other words, I wasn't going back to farming. I didn't really think there was any future in that, so I joined the service.
So you enlisted?
Yes.
And you enlisted in which branch?
The Army.
And why did you choose the Army?
They had the career path that I really wanted to go into, the education path that I wanted to go to in mechanics.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. And how old were you when you enlisted?
I was 20 years old when I enlisted.
All right. How did your parents feel about you going in? Was it a common thing for...
No.
Boys in your situation, or?
No, mother didn't like it at all. She was not real thrilled about it. But at that time, there was no war or nothing going on, so, you know, she was comfortable with it after I explained it to her.
Okay. So you saw it as a path to getting
right.
The education,
yes.
And she thought that was probably okay.
Right.
So where were you inducted? Do you remember what that whole situation was like?
I was inducted in Atlanta, Georgia. I took basic training at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Okay, so what was your induction like?
Just basically, I went with a group of guys that were joining the service, and most of them were joining because they figured if they didn't join, then they would be drafted anyway. So, you know, they were at draft age and at you know, various states of their lives.
So. Uh-huh. So how far was it from where you were in Alabama to Atlanta?
About 110 miles.
So did you just drive there? Did you?
No, they bused us there from Childersburg. I joined up in Childersburg, but you were inducted. They bused you to Atlanta.
Okay.
And it was right outside. It was pretty close to the bus station in Atlanta at the time.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's where the induction took place, the physical and everything took place.
So they picked you up at the recruiting station and
right.
Brought you in? So it was all military?
Right.
Okay. And when you got to the induction center, what was it like? How many men were there? Was it a big group of men that were being
going through? It was fairly
big
through? Group. If I remember correctly, it's about 50 of us.
Okay.
So it was a fairly big group.
So you went through and you got physicals
right.
And got assigned,
yes.
Got all your gear?
Yeah.
What happened to all your civilian gear? Did they tell you what not to bring, or did they just send it all back home?
Send it all back home. It was packaged right there at the place. They gave you a package. You put it in and address it, and it was sent back home.
Were you allowed to keep anything?
No. Not so bad.
Watch anything?
Watch, yes. Any thing you wore around your neck, like crosses or stuff like that, they didn't take. You know, you wore watches. If you had rings, you know, you could keep those. Other than that, they sent most of it back home.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you went through, were any of your buddies with you when you were inducted?
No, just me.
Just you?
Yeah.
Okay. So how long did the whole induction take?
It actually went pretty fast. I think it was the whole day was, one day was spent with just physical and stuff like that. You know, you went through a physical and a, you know, whether you would qualify for service or not. And the next day, you know, that was it. I mean, they swore you in, they put you in a room and swore you into the service, and that was it.
Okay.
Then how they did it, I don't know, but they had orders for you by the time you came out of the room, so.
Okay.
So I figured they always knew who was going to go in, so I didn't think much of it until afterwards, but I always figured they knew who was going to go.
Okay, and so your orders were for basic training.
Right, and that was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
So you went a little further north.
Yes, kept going north for some reason, couldn't figure that out.
And how did you get there?
A bus. They took us on a bus.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, a short trip?
It wasn't
about
that
a day?
Long. It was less than a day, really. It
okay.
wasn't that far away.
Okay. So, you went to Fort Jackson. How were you greeted when you got there?
When you got off the bus, you had most of your gear with you. And mm-hmm. you took it, and they put you in these, I don't know how they assigned to companies, I never tried to figure that, but they put you in a company, and you were with a group of guys, then they marched you off to your barracks.
And what were your barracks like?
One building with, the building we were in, I think, if I remember correctly, had two floors. You had an upstairs and a downstairs, and I would say maybe 30 to a floor, you know, not even 30, it was more like 25 to a floor.
Was it bunk beds or was it single
beds?
Bunk beds.
Yeah.
Were you on the top or the bottom?
Always on the bottom. Didn't like the top.
Okay.
Yeah. I always figured I'd roll off. So I wasn't used to sleeping in a bunk bed.
And you had some rules you had to follow in the barracks.
Oh, yeah.
What?
You know, you maintained your foot locker. I mean, it had to be a certain way. Your bed had to be made a certain way. And if it wasn't clean, then, you know, you went back and cleaned it again. So, you know, you had to wax the floor. It had to be waxed once a week. Everything had to be clean, and it had to be in a certain order.
If it wasn't?
It wasn't. You did it over, and you know, if there was weekend passes, they didn't give them to you.
Okay.
It was sort of a discipline, you know. It was kind of a disciplinary action they used to get people to do things they wanted them to do. And you kept shower clean, and there was details on how, you know, it was lined out. You know, you had a certain person who took orders from the sergeant in charge of your barracks. He delegated the power to one person that was in there, most like an OTC guy who had prior military in school.
Okay.
He told him what he wanted to do and how to split up. And you had certain things that you did. Certain people waxed the floor, certain people cleaned the bathroom, certain people.
What did you do?
Mostly the barracks itself, the floor and stuff like that.
Okay.
But they switched it around, so you done every. They had KP where, you know, they had to assign certain people KP, and it was just, that's the way things were. It's just they assigned certain things and you did them.
Okay.
And other than training, I mean, you did all this before training. You fell out for inspection. They had an inspection every morning. And your boots had to be shined, and your clothes had to be a certain way, and they didn't vary from it either. So
what time did you have to get up? How were you? You were gently awakened, right?
Oh yeah, by somebody yelling every morning. I always remember that one. I mean, yeah, It was generally either 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. Sometimes they let you at least sleep to six. If you had a real hard day the day before, they'd let you sleep an extra hour. But usually 5 o'clock, you got up, you went outside and you exercised, you know, did as calisthenics, and then you did run, you know, I always call it sand hill because it was nothing but sand. Then you came back to the barracks and then you showered and you went to eat breakfast.
So how much time did you have, like, to shower and eat breakfast?
Probably an hour.
Okay. Did you eat as a company?
Oh, yeah.
Everything is a unit.
Yes, everything is a unit. And if you weren't there and you missed it, guess what?
You missed it.
That was it. Yeah.
And when you went to eat, what type of food did you have? Could you have as much as you wanted?
Yeah, you could go back for seconds if they had extra. Only if they had extra.
Okay.
But most of the time, the first time through, you believe me, you had enough. Because they gave you know, this was the funny part about it. They gave you clothes. I always laughed about it because they gave you clothes that were two sizes too big for you. And I wondered why. After you got out of basic training, you found out why. The food was very calorie-oriented.
Calorie-intensive.
So, yes. You fit the clothes when you got out.
So what was a typical breakfast like?
You know, you had bacon, eggs, just like you would have normal. And sometimes they would have... The one I didn't like was K rations. They would, you know, because you were going to eat them out in the field, they, you know, served them sometimes.
So they wanted you to get used to it.
K rations were the worst. C rations were okay.
So what was the difference between the K rations and the C rations?
A lot. I mean, I think K rations were made back in World War I. I don't know. They tasted like it. I mean, it was god awful food. But you know, C rations weren't that bad.
Was one hot and one cold, or was it?
Most of it was cold. I mean, they did heat it up because it was in a barracks, but if you were out in the field, most of it was cold.
What was the K or the C? What did it stand for, do you know?
I have no idea. I really never even thought about it.
So what was the difference between what you would get in a K ration pack or C?
Well, K rations were more dry food than anything else. And I mean, it was... like I said, I think it was packaged back in World War I. I mean, I'm not sure, but it tasted like it. I mean, but C rations were, you know, food. It was high calorie and, you know, packaged right. It was in cans, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was very high calorie food. I mean, believe me. What I never understood about it is people who were heavy at the time lost weight. Mm-hmm. People who weren't heavy at the time gained it. I could never figure that one out. I mean, one guy that was in with us was a pretty heavy guy, and he lost weight like mad. And it was reverse with me. I weighed 135 pounds when I went in, and when I came out of basic training, I almost weighed 148, which is huge for me at that time, but I could never figure that one out. You know, you couldn't figure out their logic, but it worked.
But it worked.
Yeah.
So after breakfast, what did you do?
Training.
And what was your training like?
Well, you went to rifle training. You went through all the basic trainings.
Was some in the classroom, some in the field, or was it all field?
All in field. It was all field training basic. You know.
Had you learned to shoot before this? Had you been a hunter?
Oh, I was raised with guns.
Okay.
I could, you know, that was amateurs for me as far as the rifle range was. That was nothing. I mean, I was used to using a .22 rifle and shooting at some of the distances they were.
And what type of rifle did they give you?
M14.
Okay.
Yeah, and trust me, I at 500 yards, that was nothing for me. I mean, I thought it was a right. I didn't, you know, I wasn't used to shooting that good of a gun, really. So, shooting was not a problem for me. I grew up, you know, I grew up in the country, so you hunted all the time.
Right.
So, it was really not a big thing for me. But,
yeah. What other types of things did they include in your training?
They taught you mortars. They taught you... some explosive. They didn't teach you a lot because that was more at the second phase of training.
Okay.
But they taught you tactics, you know, combat tactics, how to fight as a unit, and, you know, night fighting, the difference between night and day. And it's basically just the basics of, you know, fighting as a unit is fighting together. That's basically all they taught you, hand-to-hand combat, and, you know, bayonet training, which I never thought was anywhere worth teaching because I wasn't going to get that close to him. I was that close, I was way too close. I mean, but they taught it anyway. And you taught you throwing grenades and stuff like that. So that's basically what they taught you in basic.
Okay, and how long was your basic?
6 weeks.
Were you able to communicate with everybody back home during that time?
Yes, yes. In fact, they required you to at least, you know, let your family know what's going on.
Okay.
So
that was for the first 6 weeks?
Yes.
Did you have a graduation at that point?
Yes. And they, you know, they graduated you, they gave you a certificate of completion, which was a piece of paper, really.
Did you have a ceremony?
Yeah, they had a ceremony, you know, where all of the, you know, people that had graduated, they had started together, graduated. The ones who, I don't think we lost anybody in our platoon.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think everybody graduated. At the same time, they had this ceremony where the company commander come out and talk to everybody and, you know, gave us the pep talk, as I call it.
Right.
And that's it.
And did your family come to see your graduation?
No. They would. In fact, there was no families that I know were there.
It was just all internal.
Right. It was internal.
Okay. And so after your 6 weeks, you got orders for your
next phase. It was advanced infantry training at Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Up north again, huh?
Up north, yes.
Okay.
Outside of Trenton.
Okay. And what year was this?
I want to say it was 65 when I, you know, when I went to Fort Dix, probably in June or May, June or July.
Starting to hear more about Vietnam at that point?
Yes. It started up. We could, you know, this buildup started around that time. You know,
right.
We heard about it, but we weren't really concerned about it at the time.
Okay.
Advanced infantry training was mostly heavy guns, how to use a 105 howitzer, or, you know, and mortars and stuff like that. That was advanced, and it was 6 weeks.
So how did you get to New Jersey?
Bus.
Bus again?
Yeah.
Other guys from your platoon go up there with
yes,
you?
Yes, there was four other guys. Richard Leitner, I think it was Larry Liebeck, Mike McCormick, and Pete Koenig. New Jersey guy, he loved it. he could walk, you know, like he said, he could throw a rock and hit his house from the base, so he was real happy about it. And he was the, I always call him the mischief one of the group. He got into more trouble than anybody, so he was kind of a fun person, too.
And what time of year was this?
It was mostly in the fall.
Okay.
Yeah, late summer, early fall.
Okay.
September, right around that area. And it was a 6-week class. And we went through all of that together. Then we split up. I went to airborne training in Fort Benning.
Back south.
Back south. Went back at Columbus, Georgia. Trained there for 3 weeks in the airborne training. Graduated from there, and I really don't know how I got to from there to Fort Campbell, but I went there, Fort Campbell, to the 801st.
Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Yeah, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I was in maintenance there for about, I'd say 2-3 months. And then from there, I went to Vietnam.
So how long was your training altogether between all these different
sets? 6 weeks at Fort Dix, New Jersey.
Right.
3 weeks in Fort Benning. And I don't, you know, I can't really, I was at Fort Campbell, let's see.
So was it about a 6 month
with the training? Yeah, it was about a 6 month training, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and from there, I don't, you know, I was in a maintenance company in Fort Campbell, and from there I went from Fort Campbell to Vietnam.
Okay, how much warning did you have that you were going to Vietnam?
A week.
Were you able to contact your parents and let them know?
Oh, yeah. I can remember my mother having a fit. She was not happy about it, so.
Mm-hmm. The stuff was on the news already at this point.
Oh, yeah. Everything, the buildup had already started mm-hmm. when we got there. And when I got to Vietnam, I landed in Canto.
Now how did you get to to Vietnam?
Fly.
You flew there.
Yeah.
An army plane.
Yeah. Well, no, it's commercial, believe
it was not. A commercial plane?
Yeah, it's Pan Am.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Was it all military? So it wasn't all military. It was
no, all military.
It was all military.
This was the military. It was a flight that the military
had bought.
Bought. Yeah.
Okay. what was the mood like on the flight?
Well, you know, mostly content. You know, I don't think anybody was celebrating. It's kind of quiet. I mean, you know, you were on the plane for 18 hours, so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we landed in, we landed in Alaska and Guam. I'm pretty sure it was Guam. Or not Guam, maybe. Anyway, we landed twice and we never got off the plane.
Okay.
Yeah, so, well, you know, I know we were in Alaska because I remember it being cold.
Right.
And you know, but that's about 18 hours we were in there.
So how did you spend that time?
Sleeping. I think everybody on the plane slept the whole time. I can't say enough about the stewardess on the plane. They were, exceptional, I thought.
Uh-huh.
They were real friendly. They kept everything at a light. I think they knew where we were going, and they just kept it at a light pace. I always admired them for that.
Didn't want you to worry more than...
Yes.
Yeah.
When I got off the plane, I was sitting in Tan Son Nhut Air Base in Saigon. We got off the plane, and I don't know why. My whole unit was moving to Da Nang, the 101st maintenance unit.
Okay.
And I figured that they flew us ahead, and we would meet up. Nope, never happened. They pulled us aside and says, you guys are going to be gunners on helicopters. I says,
really?
I have no idea what you're talking about. He says, no. He said, they had sent this unit over there, the helicopter unit, and they didn't have any gunners on the helicopters. They didn't have any crew chiefs or gunners on the helicopter. So.
So you thought you were going to be doing mechanical maintenance repairs?
No, far from that. I was a support group for every infantry unit in that whole area. 1st Infantry, 1st Marine Division, you supported all of them. What you did was, on the gunships, they flew escorts for people who were landed and, you know, to make sure that there was no enemy
right
within the area where they were landing, and that's what you did. You escorted them in, you escorted medevacs in when they were medevacing people, and you were on the helicopter.
Had you been on a helicopter before?
No.
That was a little different experience.
But, it was Warrant Officer Stump said, he says, I took to it like a bird. He said, you're the only person that I ever seen get on a helicopter and wasn't frightened by it. I told him, I said, you know, I don't know why I never was frightened. I always used everybody used an 8-foot cord. I used a 10-foot. Because I could go from side to side. If the fight was on this side, you know, and the bad thing about a helicopter is if you fall, you have one side or the other. But if you could move from side to side, then you get more firepower on the one side that was under attack. So that's why I used a 10-foot cord.
So what type of gun?
M60 machine gun.
Okay.
And the helicopters we were on had 4 M60s mounted on each side that were fired from the co-pilot.
Okay.
He done that. Then you had the rockets, which I hated from the start because They weren't good mechanically. I mean, someone would spin in a tube and, you know, and stay in a tube. So these things, you had to actually get out on it and work it out.
Oh, wow.
And you couldn't, you know, you couldn't take a chance on landing with it because of vibration.
Right.
And you had to work this thing out of a tube. And this thing was armed. It was an armed thing. It would explode. And that I didn't like.
What was the crew on the helicopter?
We had co-pilot, pilot, and a crew chief, and a gunner.
So four men.
The two gunners were basically crew chiefs on the helicopter. They took maintenance. They did the maintenance on the guns, everything. So they were. That's what we were, mostly maintenance. And it's like I said, we were more support vehicles for the troops going into the landing zones. And you supported medevacs when they go in to pick up a guy. You actually flew side by side with them, and when they went in there, you to protect them. So that's, you know, I never figured out why they got me in that, but you know, a lot of things I couldn't figure out about service. I mean,
so you were 20 or 21 at this point?
21 at the time.
Okay. Hmm. What was your first impression of the country when you landed?
Beautiful country. I always thought, you know, and I still to this day thought really, and I don't know if you know, this is, if they had never used Agent Orange, it would have been one of the most beautiful countries in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it had everything going for it. I still think if every country had left it alone, you wouldn't have believed what it would have looked like. I mean, I just thought it was beautiful. When you went up to Vong Tau and you go right up to that area, they had some of the best beaches in the world, and they still do. I mean, and the country itself, the people I found, you know, very friendly. But then again, like I said, you didn't know if they were your friends or I think we went at it all wrong, as myself. I mean, when you went on search and destroy missions, which we went on quite a few of them, when you go out there and burn something, you know, we did it all wrong. When you go out there and burn somebody's home and move them to a location away from where they lived all their life, they're not going to be very friendly with you.
Right.
They're not going to like you at all. And that's the worst thing we did. We destroyed their forest. We destroyed the, you know, and that's no way to fight a war. And then, you know, you had the people against you from the start. You don't know how many enemies we made just burning down villages.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of it. And that I always disapproved of. I always thought that was the wrong way to go. And one colonel says, well, it gives them no place to hide. They already had places to hide. They had 40 years to build them.
Right.
And, you know, they didn't hide in the villages. They had in the Saigon and the populated areas. You didn't know which ones they were.
Right.
And they put our guys at I always thought they put them in a very bad disadvantage. Because Viet Cong and North Vietnamese picked whatever fight they wanted to get into. They didn't come out and just say, well, we're going to draw this line, we're going to fight you. No, they didn't do that. They picked the fights. They would fight you and then they'd leave. And they kept you in there. And the bad thing about it was our country, all the people in our country didn't want the war, and they could read too. And if you don't think that all those demonstrations out there had a bad effect, it did. To my, you know, I understand why they were demonstrating. I understand it. But they don't really know how many people they killed doing that, because it gave them every incentive to keep fighting. And it was some good things and some bad things about it. Me, I never thought we should have been there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought we fought it wrong. We went, how do I explain it? You're fighting a person, and he's got home field advantage.
Right.
He's trained for 40 years, you've trained for one. I mean, guess who has the advantage here?
Right.
All of the emplacements they had over there were built, you know, 20 years before we ever got there. The tunnels, all those tunnels they found, they were 20 years before we ever got there. They don't know how many tunnels were there. And then at the end of the war, you saw, you know, they showed all the tunnels. We'd have never beat them.
Right.
Never. They could come out from underground shoot at you and then go back underground. Which always brings me back to the one sniper we had at when we were at Fulloy. We were based there for about 3 months. This guy would come out at night. He'd shoot. For some reason, he had a resentment for our mess hall. I don't know what it was. I think it was because it was the biggest building around. He'd come out, shoot two or three rounds, put holes in the roof. Then he'd go back in. Well, this new commanding officer came over there, and this one sergeant, I always remember him, he wanted us to go out and
find
kill the sniper. And that sergeant told him, no, they're not going out and doing anything. He says, what do you mean? He says, no, we're not going to go out and kill him. And the guy says, why? He says, well, he's been out there for almost a year, and the only thing he's hit is the missile. He says, you might get a guy who can shoot. I always laughed about that. And I was there when he told the commanding officer that. He said, you get a guy out there who really can shoot. I said, "That's you don't want that." And he got his way. I mean, it was just so funny. Every two or three days, he'd come out, shoot two or three shots into. And when you flew over, and I always thought this was funny, you flew over the mess hall, you see all these little black dots. That's where they patch the holes. And I tell you, when they say monsoon season, it is nothing like you think it is. It starts to rain. I mean, the skies over there were as clear as day. I mean, there was no clouds in the sky at all. When you started seeing clouds, then you better start worrying because the monsoon season was moving in. And when they say rain, you don't know what rain is. When it starts to rain, for about 4 months there, that's all it does. It'll just rain. If you ever watched the movie Forrest Gump, uh-huh. When they were showing the rain, that's exactly how it rains. It's just a steady, no wind, nothing. It's just steady rain. Nothing cotton will last over there.
Right.
The mildew will rot it away off, and they rot leather off your feet. That's why they went to canvas boots and rubber boots, because no darn nothing leather like would last. I had a pair of brand new leather shoes that sat under my bunk for, you know, the whole time I was there, and, you know, I was intending on wearing them home. Well, and you know, I never moved them because you really never worry. The day I moved them, the soles stayed there. The shoe came off and the soles. I sat there and I said, you know, nothing lasts them. If people want to know why the Oriental people wear silk, you know why they do?
It lasts.
It won't rot. Yeah. Mildew has no effect on silk. So that was why. But, you know, I always found, you know, the people that I did get to know over there were nice people. I think they just resented, you know, they didn't want the war no more than anybody else did.
Right.
I mean, so.
So tell me, when you got there and you're going to be a gunner on a helicopter, tell me about the first time you were on that helicopter and had to shoot.
They took us out, you know, to see if we could shoot from, you know, me, it wasn't a matter of being able to shoot from a helicopter.
Right, right.
It was just, you know, they wanted to see if we could, you know, the flying. They wanted to see actually who, there were people who weren't afraid of, flying.
Right.
Really. We had two people on the plane when we went over there that were definitely, you know, they had to sit up front because they got sick from flying.
Mm-hmm.
And me, I don't know. I took to it. I mean, I didn't fear it. I would hang outside of the helicopter. You know, it's like Warren Harper Stump said, he'd never seen anything like it. He said, you know, you just took to it right away. And I don't know. I mean, I never really had a problem with it. I mean, they practice you when you first get there.
Right.
Because they had sent a company. What was amazing about it, they had sent this company of helicopters over there and didn't have gunners on it to begin with. And then found out, you know, hey, you had to get somebody. And unfortunately, fortunately, I always believed that, you know, maybe it was, you know, destined. Because I think if I would have been on the ground with, you know, I was a chance I would get shot or something. So in the helicopter, I always felt safe. We had the great pilots. I mean, you can't say anything bad about our pilots. They would handle anything, and especially the warrant officers. I was always impressed with them because these guys, were unbelievable at flying. They'd fly right on top of the trees. They didn't, you know, mm-hmm. they didn't have no fear whatsoever. And, you know, I was always impressed with their flying.
And what type of helicopters were they?
Hueys, B-1. You had the H Hueys, which were the troop carriers, and the B-1s, which were the gunships. The
okay.
ones that carried the guns. Once in fact, and I flew in both, so.
Okay.
Yeah, so it wasn't, when we worked with the Australians out of Bong Tao, I flew with the D models, because I was really not a heavy kid, but, you know, I was kind of a skinny kid. And if you've ever seen Australian, they're not exactly small people. So we carry 7 American troops and 5 Australians.
Okay.
So that showed you, they were big people.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, that was the most fun people in the world. They were still fun. We had some great times with them. I mean, they could fight anybody. They'd go out in the jungle looking for a fight. Well, we told them, I said, I don't like working with you guys. I said, why? Every time we pick you up, we're in a fight. So they were pretty nice people, though.
So you were gunner on a ship, gunner on a helicopter, rather.
Right.
And did you get into any skirmishes where you had to use your...
Oh, yeah. Plenty of them.
Like, tell me the first time. What was it?
First
like?
Time we were in Bearcat. It was a... it had to be... It was an outpost. It was way out in the middle of nowhere. And they attacked tonight, early in the morning. The first time we ever really got into a fight was a Special Forces right outside of Fuloy. They had come under attack, and when we got the word, we were far away from them. All our gunships were just about ready to take off anyway, and we were, what were we going to do? We were going to support a group, I think it was in Lyke, and they said they were under attack. They called in, and we were already armed and ready to go. And so when we got there, I mean, it was kind of a mismatch because we caught them out in the open. When you do that, helicopter is deadly out in the open. So, and I think there were 139 killed that night. So I don't know. I don't know. They never did say how many Special Forces guys got hurt or killed.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I know they were, we caught them out. I don't know if you've ever seen graveyards in the Orient. They're made of helicopter, you know, or volcanic ash.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The bullet hits them, it's like an explosion.
Right.
And they caught them out, and then this, and then a lot of them were killed from the secondary explosion from the bullets hitting.
Mm-hmm.
So, they were a lot, that's the one time that happened about 2 weeks after we got there, and that's the realization. That was when it came to, when we landed and all of it, that was a realization. That was when it hit home.
That it's real.
Yes, that this is real. This is not a game anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This is not practice. This is real. I think that's when I realized all I wanted to do was get home in one piece.
Right.
I didn't care how I did it, but I also found out that I could fight when I come down to it. I could fight, and I could shake afterwards, but I wasn't afraid when I was fighting.
The adrenaline took over.
Yeah, the fighting, you know, the shaking came out, you know, I'd come out, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, I'd come out, I was scared to death. I mean, after I come out, you realize what happened.
Right.
Yeah, so.
So how many, how many recoveries or how many escorts did you do? How many times did you have to go up? And?
Oh, geez. They're, you know, like I said, that's tough. That one's a tough one. They would be 4 to 12 a week you
okay.
go out. I mean, it just depended on, sometimes you went out 4 days, you would support a group for 4 days, and you'd sleep in a helicopter. That's, you know, that was your... You know, it was actually your home, really.
Uh-huh.
I slept in the helicopter more than I slept in my bunk.
So, what were your living conditions like when you weren't in the helicopter?
Well, they had, when we first went there, it was tents. And then they, you know, they built permanent structures. You know, you were in concrete because the tents you put up, they had a barrier, but it's sand. It was sandbags.
Right.
Around, you know. And they built permanent structures because bullets wouldn't penetrate the concrete blocks that they made. So,
how many men were in the tents? Like per tent?
Two, four. It was single bunks, so 2, 4, 6, 8, about 16.
Were they regular bunks?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, not regular bunks. They were, you know, the folding type food bunks.
But like, it was more than a cot.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when they built the concrete structures,
you just moved your stuff.
The same arrangement, same.
It was 4 to a room.
Okay.
Yeah, 4 to a room. So, I think the reason for building the concrete thing was, you know, bullets didn't penetrate the concrete as easy as they would penetrate a tent.
Right. And when you had a mess hall.
Yep.
And what kind of food did you get when you were there?
When you were at the base, it was about the same food you would get anywhere else. I mean, you know, regular food. I mean, they brought it in, and they had regular bakeries that bake, you know, bread and stuff. Eggs, you know, you had the eggs on bacon, and sometimes you had different, like, K-ration or C-ration stuff, you know, just so you didn't get real used to it. I think that was all important. But mostly they took, it was hot food, so it was, you know, kind of basically the same thing you would get when you were in this.
Was it tasty?
Huh?
Was it tasty?
Oh, yeah. Very tasty. Very, you know, calorie intensified is
right.
What I call it. You
right.
know, a lot of calories because you burn a lot.
Right.
And the heat over there was, 112 was nothing. I mean, I don't see how the people lived there, but it was hot. It was really hot.
Even coming from the south.
Yes, coming from the south. I mean, if I didn't say that from the south, I mean, because it got out down there, nothing like this. Nothing. It was very hot.
Was there anything they did to help you adjust to the heat?
No.
It was just
You just had to adjust to it. And you generally worked it out. I mean, I found that I could stand it. I could stand it better than most people. A lot of people had trouble with it, but I heat rash and stuff like that. Me, I never, because I came from the south. I came from the heater. I was used to going without a shirt, or, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And most of that was to cool down stuff. You didn't have swimming pool. You had showers and all that, but you know, what are you going to do when during the day? You're not going to go in the shower every, you know, hour or two. But no, generally they took pretty well care of the soldiers. I mean, I have really no complaint about the food
mm-hmm.
or about, you know, the way they were took care of them. They did that. I mean, and when you were out in the field, you had C-rations.
Mm-hmm.
And C-rations, any box of C-rations is a meal. Half the time you couldn't eat it all anyway. So, you know, it's basic. That was where another thing we didn't plan on too. We didn't realize, you know, their soldiers could live off of a pound of rice a week. And, you know, the most food we found on soldiers when they were killed in action, or Vietnamese soldiers, were a small amount of rice and some, you know, some dried meat and some, that's the most we found on them.
Right.
So they were, you know, they were very well equipped to fight, you know, they could fight on a limited amount of food.
A smaller in stature
yeah.
and smaller
yeah.
in build.
And they could, you know, and I don't care what they tell you, those people, you know, those soldiers could fight. And that they may have been small in stature, and they were very well outnumbered and outgunned. But like I said, they picked the time, they picked the place. And you fought them on their terms. You didn't fight on your terms. That was the difference.
So did you encounter any surprises in the fighting? Were you in any situations where you were attacked that was totally unexpected? Or
yes, Lai Kee. Lyckie was the, we had gotten too complacent at Lyckie. We built a runway and everything, and we had never gotten attacked. And the, about, oh, I'd say a week before it was completed, totally by surprise, the attack took place. It caught us all off guard.
During the day or night?
At night. We lost, you know, I mean, in the first round, we lost 3 helicopters. They burnt on the ground. I mean, you know, they just come out of nowhere. And I mean, it wasn't like it was heavy jungle or nothing like that, but they came out of nowhere. And they didn't lose many men that night in the fight, really. They only lost, I think, 11 or 12. And everybody said, oh, they dragged their dead away. No, I got a feeling that was all they lost.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had planned it really well. Because what they had picked every target, and they had hit every target they wanted to. They put 7 helicopters out of commission because, you know, the bullets, they had to check everything, and they burnt 3 of them. So, yeah, they were pretty well organized. They knew what they were doing. They were watching. So,
when, I mean, we hear in the military about not leaving a man behind on
right.
a battlefield. So that is something that you experienced. You were part of the crew that had to retrieve.
Right. I, you know, and, you know, it's all built into America, the way American trains. I mean, you know, all the guys, American soldiers are unique in their own sense. They are unique because of the simple fact that they believe that when you're in a fight, that everybody is in it together and you don't leave anybody. If it's at all possible, you do not leave them. And if it's not possible for you to get them right then you go back and get them. And they do, you know, that is a sense of how the military, the soldiers work together. It has nothing to do with the way we're training. I think it's just the people's psyche, their self. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think it's the soldiers. They don't want to leave their comrades behind. They don't want them in the enemy's hands. And I think it doesn't have anything to do with the way they were trained. I think it's the way they think. And our military, bar none, is the best in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I will put them against anybody in a straight up fight. I mean, you have not seen one a Marine division of 19, 20, you know, 19 to 24 year olds get pissed off. They are not something you want to fool with,
right?
Because they will fight you to the death. I mean, I have the greatest respect for our soldiers. I mean, our soldiers are, bar none, the best in the world.
Did you ever have to leave someone behind? And
I didn't, but I know some of the Marine or some of the First Infantry guys, especially with the 4th Cav, they would fight in to get a person, and you know that was the craziest group of people that ever lived. I mean, but they would. They left, you know, a couple of guys that they, you know, and they were all upset about it. They wanted to go back right away and get them. But they were outnumbered, really. So they really didn't have any choice in it. But they, you know, they just didn't want to leave anybody. I mean, they knew that the soldiers were dead, but they just didn't want to leave them. I mean,
right.
It's just a psyche that all of them have. And I don't know where it comes from. It doesn't come from training. It comes from just them people caring about somebody. That's what it is.
So nowhere in your training
right.
do they tell you we don't leave anyone behind?
No. Nowhere in your training they don't.
That just was
that's
something
that's the psyche of the soldier. I mean, that's just how the American soldier works. And like I said, I don't know where it comes from. It's not trained. It's just their psyche. They do not want to leave their comrades, the ones they're fighting with, behind. That's just, I don't think that's built into any training manual.
Now, when you found soldiers that had been killed from the other side,
right?
Did you have any orders on searching
not
through
really.
Their what they not had,
really.
Or you just did?
Really, no. I did. The only thing I didn't like about it was the way they were treated. I mean, they were treated like they didn't matter, and that to me.
Like what?
Well, the way they, you know, they'd stack them up like wood, really. In one instance, I saw they stacked them up like wood, and that's just That's not the way you treat a person that's dead. A guy, and you know, even though you didn't like him and you were fighting him, it's still you respect him when he's dead. You don't treat a body like that. You don't. I mean, and that I didn't like. I didn't like at all. And that was the gory part of it. The thing I think hurt me the most was seeing friends of mine being carried away and knowing when they zipped the bag up, he was gone. I mean, that hurt. And I think that was the only thing I disliked about it.
Did you have any rituals for when comrades were lost?
No. I mean, that they all, you know, said their farewells over it. And but most of the time when they were gone before you got back. If you got in a fight, most of them had died, had already left, and already been taken. They didn't like to show soldiers dead soldiers.
Right.
I think it all had to do with psyche. It played on their psyche, and some of them, you know, just didn't like that.
There's obviously, you know, a lot going on and a lot of stress and tension when you're in these situations. Yeah. What did you do to relieve some of that stress?
Me, I like being alone. I really, you know, I would, when everybody else was, you know, back at, I just go sit in my helicopter and just, when it was out on the line, it was, you know, nobody there to bother you.
Did you read? Did you sleep? Did you write?
Just sat there, you know, and sometimes read. I mean, that was about all you could do over there, really. You either went to the NCO club where they people drank, and I didn't drink anyway, so, and usually got into a fight, but I got into a few of those, but none of my starting, though. And, you know, I always couldn't figure that out. I never started them, but I always got into them for some reason.
And what were these fights about?
Things that were said. I mean, you know, one group got macho, got to drinking, got macho, and then they just, I think it was more relief tension. Hey, the next day they all be working together anyway, so it really, that's just, I think it was just relief tension. I don't think anybody meant any harm by it, but they get in there, you know, it was a normal thing, especially, you know, and it always seemed to happen after we'd been on a mission for, you know, it always seemed to, just relief tension.
Yeah.
I mean, most of them were friends the next day anyway, so they never really harmed. I don't think we ever got into a fight where anybody had to, you know, go to the infirmary for anything. So it was kind of just relieving stuff, getting it out of the way.
Did you have downtime where you could?
Yes.
What did you do?
I went to Hong Kong. Went to Hong Kong the first time and went to Australia the second for a week.
For a week?
Yeah. Just they did give you time. To, you know, they gave you a break. And then the field we were in, boy, believe me, they needed it because you were called up within a, you know, you could be sitting there, you know, doing nothing, and all of a sudden, you know, you got to be in, you know, in Da Nang or in Lai Ki or in Tianjin. I mean, and it was a minute's notice. I mean, you had time to grab your stuff and get on a plane. That was or on a helicopter. That was it. Because, you know, they would come under attack, and all of a sudden you're back in the air.
Right.
Yeah, so. But I think, I really liked the country, believe it or not. I mean, as bad as, you know, things were, I always thought it was very unusual country. I mean, because as bad as it was, the people seemed to, you know, if you went out in these villages, these towns, small, it didn't seem to affect them. I mean, mm-hmm. It was just their attitude that, you know, just amazed me. And people in this country really don't know how good they got it, to tell you the truth. When you walk in and a family invites you in for dinner and you're eating on a dirt floor, mm-hmm. your table and everything, you really don't know how good you got it here.
Right.
And this is one of the upper class people. They got a house.
Yeah.
I mean, I told people when I come back, you guys don't know how good you got it. I mean, they don't have wooden floors. They'd sweep the dirt. I mean, it just amazed me how they got by with such little. and modern convenience was nothing. I mean, they didn't have radio, they didn't have tape. And I mean, they got by on practically nothing. They could survive on stuff. I was always amazed. You know, you go into their houses, I mean, if they had food for the day, they were happy.
Right.
And so.
So when you would go and they would take you like to Australia or Hong Kong for your week break, did you fly out by helicopter, by plane?
Commercial jet.
Commercial jet?
Yeah.
Okay.
They flew you commercial. And sometimes you flew military, but I flew to Hong Kong on a military plane, but I flew to Australia on a commercial plane, just like, you know, any other plane.
So, but a commercial plane that was used by the military?
Well, no, you know, the one I flew on had people that were flying to Australia. I mean,
okay.
South Vietnamese, business people. It was just a regular flight.
Okay.
Tanjung Air Base was pretty big. I mean, it wasn't a small airport.
Okay. So when you went to Hong Kong, for example, did you stay on a base? Did you stay in a hotel?
No, I stayed in a hotel.
Did the military set it all up? Or?
Yeah, they set it up and, they paid for it. I mean, it was paid for by them, so it was set up by them. But most of the people in the hotel were just regular customers. It wasn't military, you know, by any standard. Like,
right.
They, you know, they just put you up in the nearest hotel. So, and it was nice. I mean, Hong Kong, you're not going to see, you know, much in a week.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Hong Kong is one of those places where if you don't go for a month, you don't see nothing.
Right.
Yeah, so it was more like you just stayed in a district and you relaxed, and that was about it. I did meet a Chinese family, you know, were real nice. I met the guy's son, and, you know, I don't know why. I was on this, you know, walking down the street, and we just started up a conversation. He spoke very good English. I always remember that. And he says, well, why don't you come to our place? We're having a birthday party for my sister. And he says, why don't you come to it? He says, well, you know, there's not going to be a lot of people there. And I went to the party. You know, they eat stuff that I wouldn't eat. But, I mean, when you got food that looks back at you, I'm not really that into it. And they fish head stuff I wasn't real thrilled about. But it was a great time and really nice family. So, you know, I had a good time, but, and then he actually, he said he wasn't working that week, and he wound up taking us to certain places and stuff, so it was nice of him.
So you got to see things that you wouldn't have seen.
Yeah, and you got to see things that, you know, normal tourists wouldn't go to.
Right.
So, you know, but it was, you know, it was kind of fun, but you know what, that was a good time. In Australia, I mean, you can go anywhere around there and have a good time. I mean, that's all those people do. Especially if you know people, I mean, you know. And
did you know anyone from the military?
No, I operated with a guy named McCory. And he lived in Australia. And I stayed with his family when I was there. I didn't stay at the hotel. And, God, you're talking about people at party. Jesus, people party. I mean, and they have a good time. I mean, and, you know, it's like I said, a lot of our people, should, you know, would be wise to start living like that. I mean, they live from day to day. They just have a good time. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, that was the best time I had, really. I mean, I had a good time in Hong Kong. I had a good time both. But then again, I, you know, like I said, I don't expect much when I go places, so I'm usually have a good time wherever I go.
So you would be gone for a week, and then you'd have to go back.
Right.
What was that reentry into the situation?
It wasn't fun. I mean, you get a week away, you didn't want to go back. And when I got hurt, I was in Saigon Hospital.
So tell us how you got hurt.
It was in a helicopter accident, a crash. So, you know, I got severe concussion and fracture skull.
Okay.
So I was in there for 6 days, and they had written my mother. It started because I got on I was scheduled to go with one pilot. I got on a helicopter with another one, and nobody knew where I was at. So when it actually happened, I was in the hospital, so I was unconscious, and only person that knew where I was at was George Wilson, and he was the guy that I was telling you about, took me there. And
tell us again, that was before we recorded.
George Wilson, he was just, a black guy from Philadelphia. And how we wound up friends, I never know. Because, me being from the South, like he said, he never figured out why we become friends. I told him, I said, because I don't mean nothing to me, you're black. I mean, you're just another person. But we become real good friends. His helicopter was the one that picked us up. And he kept me from bleeding to death, really. Because he stayed with me the whole time we were going to the hospital.
Kept pressure?
Yeah, he kept pressure on it, kept it from bleeding. And the worst thing over there in Vietnam in the summer is bleeding to death. I mean, because your blood is so thin from that heat. And like the captain that did the surgery, or that I saw when I went in there, he says, you weren't dead from the injury. He said, you weren't dying from the injury. He said, you didn't have any blood. He said, when you came in here, you had lost almost 2/3 of your blood.
Wow.
He said, you were on the verge of dying. He said, if they'd have been any later, it's like I said, when I saw my uniform that they took off of me, I thought the guy in there had died because they had blood from the top all the way down. The pants, everything were bloody.
Now, had the crash happened when, had the helicopter been shot down?
I think it was, everybody says it was shot down. I think it was maintenance because, when I was in it, I didn't hear anything.
Okay.
I didn't hear a bullet hit, and usually you will hear it hit. All I heard was a ping sound, and, it was like something broke.
Okay.
And we started to, it's auto-rotate. I remember it, but it happened so darn fast, and we were so low. I mean, it was just like it happened, and then we hit the ground. And, and when you hit the ground, the skid, that landing thing on the helicopter,
right,
broke, flipped it.
Okay.
And that's where I caught the gun right in the...
Right in the head.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so...
So...
And they, it was like a bang, bang, and then the last thing I remember, and I remember the helmet just shattering and going into pieces, because it was like a movie, all the pieces were going that way. And the helmet was really what saved my life, because if it hadn't been for that, like I said, it probably took the top of my head off, is what it would have done. And I always remember the last words I heard is George Wilson coming up, and I'm, stunned. I'm, in a daze, and he coming up and says, are you all right? And I always told him after that, I said, George, so that was the dumbest thing anybody ever said to me. I said, I'm sitting here bleeding. And he said, he said, I said it, I asked you, and he said, you just pitched forward. He said, you just fell. I told him, I said, I didn't even know what happened.
Yeah.
But when it got to Saigon, like the guy said, it wasn't the injury, it was the bleeding. He said, you almost bled to death. And 6 days later, I think I woke up 2 or 3 times, and then I woke, and I always remember this little Navajo nurse. I always, her name was Jackie. I could never figure out why she was named Jackie. But her standing over me, and she says, are you Coy Alexander? I said, yeah. She says, your mother, you need to call her. I says, why? He said, they sent her a letter that you were missing in action.
Oh, geez.
I said, oh, God. I knew my mother. Oh, she had a fit. Well, my sister says, how did she, Ann put it? Said she read the letter, and she read it to Ann. Ann got upset. And then my mother said, stop crying. Ann was crying. And she said, stop crying. He's okay. She said, that's the only thing she said. Said, he's okay. He's, and they actually, I always thought the Army was good at that. They walked a phone, took a phone line. They made a phone line to where my bed was. Brought the phone down there, and I talked to her.
And how was she when she heard your voice?
Oh, she was happy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She was thrilled. And I told her, why would they send a letter? Like, you know, it was always upsetting to me, but they said, they, you know,
standard
nobody
procedure.
Knew where I was at.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, my mother, I tell you what, like that guy said, everybody in the whole United States Army knew that I was missing because she called everybody. And they walked the phone down there. And that was the only thing that upset me, really. But then again, she wasn't upset about it. My sister said, she turned around and looked at her, stop crying. He's okay. So
other than this phone call to your mom when you were in the hospital,
yeah,
after she'd called everybody trying to reach
right.
you, how did you communicate with them regularly?
Oh, yeah. I communicated with my mother. I didn't talk to her, but I sent her letters all the time. So, and
was
the first
there,
thing they made me do was sit down, write her a letter, and I wrote her a letter. I'm fine. Just got injured. I'm fine. Nothing wrong. I didn't lose anything, so... She thought I was going to come home. That was the only thing that upset her, that they didn't send me home.
That's why she was feeling okay, was because she thought this is your way out.
Yeah. But, like I told her, I says, you know, I'm fine. I have nothing wrong. And, you know, got a bad headache. That's about it.
So how long were you in the hospital?
6 days.
And after that?
Back to my unit.
And back to work?
Back to work. And, you know, and... I wasn't bad off, really. I mean, like I said, you know, I went back. I never had any lasting effects from it. So.
Okay. But you said George Wilson.
He passed away. He was in the, they had went to, I think it was called Coochie, and he got in a fight. You know, it was in a, they went in to help somebody, pull somebody out, and they had gotten hit, and when they were flying out, and the helicopter dipped forward and turned over and crashed, and that killed everybody on the board,
including George.
Yeah.
And you said that was just shortly after?
2 weeks.
2 weeks after your accident.
Yeah. And I always thought that, you know, what a way, well, you know, what a waste. He was a great person. I liked him from the, you know, I guess I liked him from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Me and him, we never looked at each other as anything other than two people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
Yeah. But he was a great person. Always thought the world of him. And, yeah, you know, it's like I said, he was just a good person.
Right.
Yeah. I never got, you know, the only thing I regret is I didn't get to meet his family when I came home. I wanted to at least meet their family, his family. But I never did get to do that, so that always.
Where was he from?
Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah, so I never got to meet his family, so that was the only thing that I was, you know, really regret, not meeting. So other than that, then I mean, they came in with orders that I was going home.
So how long were you in Vietnam altogether?
Altogether, I was in Vietnam, I would say 11 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Flying the gunner on the helicopter the whole time?
Not the whole time. I did do convoy work. I mean, I guarded convoys, which is the one thing I quit within a week. I didn't realize that when you went down Highway 1, I mean, and you're sitting, you're on a convoy that has about 5,000 gallons of JP4 in a tanker that you're sitting in. Wasn't a good thing to do. It really wasn't a good job. And I always thought, I said, one bomb, that's all it would take.
That's right.
And I said, yeah, this job is not for me. So I went back and went back on helicopters for about 2 months. Then they sent me home. And they came in and asked me, did I want to release early? And I said, yes.
They asked if you wanted to release early?
Yeah, if you wanted to get out early. I said, yeah, and they sent me home.
Did they give you a reason for, because this
no.
was still during the draft, right?
I know, it was still during the draft, but I don't know what happened, but.
Did you have, was it the points?
Yeah, you only, the point system never mattered to me. I mean, I didn't care about the darn point system. I think it was because, we had been there for almost a year, so
mm-hmm.
that was generally the only, you know, that was the I think that was the limit.
Okay.
Of how long they wanted you to stay there as a year.
Okay.
And fortunately, my year was 3 months before, was I think about 3 months before I was due to get out anyway.
Okay.
So they asked me if I wanted early, you know, they didn't ask me, they told me I was going to get an early out. And I said, okay. And that was the end of it. I flew back home.
Where did you fly back to?
Hawaii, believe it or not. I told them, why couldn't I come here when I was coming? I mean, you know, what aggravated me the most is we didn't get any time in Hawaii. I mean, we only got to stay there about 4 hours, then we had to fly on. I told them, I said, you know, this is a place I could have went on RR. They were guys that went there. Yeah, but I told them, I said, you know, I always thought I got jipped in that deal. I mean, but I'll say one thing. I mean, I still think we got the best army in the world. I don't, bar none.
Yeah.
And you got to admire them. Like I said, you put 300 Marines on, I'll put them against any 300 men in the world. I mean, they're no match for those guys. Yeah. Those guys can fight anybody. But you just can't put them in a position to where they don't know who they're fighting.
Right.
Or, you know, when they're going to fight. You can't do that to them. And
yep.
That's, you know, just, that's a shame that it was done like that. But we went into that whole thing over there unprepared for what, and we should have known if they threw the British out and they threw the French out, you weren't going to do much better.
Yeah.
I mean, and the French had an Air Force, and the British had an Air Force. We had an Air Force. We have great equipment, but you can't fight a war. That the war that they fought.
So you flew back, you stopped over in Hawaii for 4 hours.
Right, went back to Fort Dix and was discharged at Fort Dix, New Jersey.
At Fort Dix, okay. Did your family Did your family know you were on your way home?
Nope. I never told them until I got home. I walked.
Why didn't you tell them?
Because I wanted to surprise them.
Okay.
When I went home, my mother was, you know.
So they saw you at the door?
Yeah. That's when that was the only time they knew I was coming home.
And your mom didn't like pass out on you?
Well, no, she had a fit, but she was mad because I didn't tell her at a time. But I think she was happy. I mean, she was kind of, you know, my mother was very funny. She had 14 kids. What was she going to do? I mean,
okay,
I always remember that statement she made to me when I walked through the door. She said, you know, she said, I know you're home now, and I know you're happy to be here. She said, but you'll be the one to leave and won't come back. I said, what do you mean? She says, you'll be the one that'll leave this
area,
you know, area and you won't come back. And guess what?
She was right.
I'm the only one that ever left tonight. I told her, well, she knew something. I mean, but she was kind of funny about the kids, though. She wanted a lot of kids, and she got them.
Yep.
And I got 72 nieces and nephews.
Wow. So when you got back home, other than surprising your parents, I mean, did they have a party, or did they?
Had a party. I mean, they had, you know, kind of, it was kind of a family get together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, uncles and aunts came over, and, you know, it was just a regular party. And
What's the first thing you did when you got back?
Believe it or not, went fishing. I missed that more than I did anything. I love to fish, and I missed that morning. I went for 3 days. I went fishing. I told my mother, I said, it's the one thing I missed more than anything. I mean, I love to fish, and there was no place over there to fish. So that's what I did. I mean, I told her I'm very happy, and she says, well, they won't bother you. I said, no, they're not going to bother me. I'm going fishing. I went fishing for 3 days, and that was it. I was perfectly fine after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
You got you back grounded back at home.
Right. That's right. And then I told my mother, I said, well, I'm going to Chicago to visit my brother. And
so you had a brother here already?
Al lived up here.
Okay.
You know, my oldest brother lived here. And you remember the snowstorm?
In 67.
Yeah, 67. Yes. Believe it or not, I came up here 3 days after the snowstorm. And I told my brother, he always wanted me to visit, and I said, Does this snow like here just all the time here? He says, well, not really. I says, well, I hope not, because I'm going back home. It was warmer than it. And I got up here and I got to work for United Insurance. Then I went to work for Western Electric. And I said, you know, there's no jobs down there. We're, you know, going south. So that I wound up staying up here.
So you came up here to visit your brother, but also to look for work?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I wound up, the first job I had was with United Insurance. I didn't like it there. And I applied at Western Electric. And I worked for them for 10 years. And most of it was with AT&T anyway. And I remember, I think it was they went on strike. And I didn't like that. So, IBM had openings, and that's when I went to work for IBM.
And that's where you spent 31 years?
Yes.
All right.
My brother moved back south, and I stayed here. So he asked me, was I going with him? I said, no. Nope. There's nothing for me there.
So why did your brother go back?
He always wanted to go back.
Okay.
He never was a city person. He always liked the country. He liked the small town. He didn't like Chicago at all. So he just moved back. He got a job down there with a trailway bus company. And so he decided I could probably live anywhere. I mean, no city bothers me. I mean, city, country, I can live in the country, I can live in the city. I mean, I really have no preference as to where I live. Me and Carol moved out to Crestwood when it was nothing there, really, but an airport.
Right.
Everybody followed us. I told her, I said, we moved to get out of the city, and I'll be darned if the city moved with us. If you looked at that place right now, I mean, the biggest store around there was Kmart,
right,
on 159th Street. That was that little shopping center there. That was the only shopping center around there.
Yep.
When we first moved down, I told her, I said, it's amazing. Everybody moved with us. Now it's all around us. I told Carol, I said, you got Walmart, Target, Kohl's, and food store, everything.
That's right.
You don't have to go nowhere, but.
Now, since you've come back, have you kept in touch with anyone you met in the service? Do you go to any veterans organizations? Or?
I kept in touch with Pete and Larry Leitner and Larry Liebeck. Pete died of cancer. Leitner, he died of thyroid cancer. And Liebeck, I guess he's in Florida now. He was going to move to, last time I talked to him, he was going to move to Florida with his wife. They're in their 70s, so.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only three that I kept up with, so.
You belong to any veterans organizations?
No. Will not join a veterans organization.
Not interested?
Not interested. Not interested in the parades, not interested in bringing up any of the old. All those groups talk about is what they did in the war, and that I can do without. I don't. I lost some friends in it.
Right.
And I lost a lot of them. And I just think it was a waste of some very good people, and that's why I hate us being in any war. I mean, these kids don't deserve to be over there. They deserve to protect this country just like they were. Like they train for, not protect some other country that doesn't care about us. And you and I both know we're in countries that do not like us.
Right.
And to me, they should all be here. I don't like seeing any kid get killed. I mean, a family having to go through that. I really don't. And to know when I was injured, how my mother reacted. And, I don't see mothers react. I don't see people having to react that way. They shouldn't have to. Unless they're protecting their own country and they're sitting here fighting it, I don't think they should be anywhere. I think they should be right here where they belong. And like I said, our military is the best in the world, no bar none. I have the greatest respect for all those kids that do the fighting, and this country should, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't know what it's like until you're in the middle of it, and to see a guy just devoted to a country's to a bike part, I mean, that's impressive to me.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I got a guy waiting on me.
Okay. Anything we haven't covered yet that?
No, nothing that I can think of.
All right. Well, in that case, we will go off record. So thank you for sharing your story.
I'm glad to. I mean, I am not ashamed of it.